All right. Well, we finished chapter 3 with some interesting comments about the differences between reading the text from a Jewish Orthodox perspective, a Messianic Jewish Orthodox perspective, and reading the text as though Paul were somehow endorsing a Christian theology. And the same thing is going to continue through this letter, because obviously most of the commentary on Romans comes from Christian scholars, right? They're, and Christian pastors. They read the letter as Paul's summary theology from a Christian perspective, and so they don't ask, well, wait a minute, how would that be understood if Paul never had the conversion experience that the Christian church claims and continued to be a practiced Torah observant Jewish Orthodox rabbi? How would that change what he says? And just before we get started on 4, I just want to make another comment on that, because I want you to think about how odd this whole situation is. First, imagine getting a letter, a 16-chapter letter from somebody that you've never met. I mean, think about this. Paul writes this, what we would consider a huge letter. It's a personal letter, right? He's not writing a theological tome. He's not trying to give, a manual of instruction. He's writing a personal letter to a congregation, an assembly in a synagogue in Rome, and they know his reputation, but they've never met him. He probably never saw them. Imagine how much effort went into communicating this message with all of this detail to this congregation. And then ask yourself, why would he do that? I mean, that just struck me today. Here, I can understand, okay, so he wrote letters to the Corinthians, he wrote letters to Thessalonica, to Ephesus, because he'd been there, he knew the people, he recognized what their problems were, he was trying to address their behavior, right? But this letter goes to a synagogue in Rome that he's never met anybody there. And by reputation only, he has to address issues that he has heard are involved in this assembly. But he provides all of this background. I mean, he doesn't do that in any other letter. He's not, look at the development of this thing. Chapter 1, all of the foundation in Habakkuk, all of the explanation of application to not only the Genesis account, but to the contemporary Roman society. Chapter 2, a long discussion about the relationship between Gentile and Jew when it concerns the Torah. Chapter 3, more expansion on how all this affects the world at large and sets up Paul for his argument about what the relationship is between Jews and Gentiles. I mean, think about the effort that he's going through to develop all this. I can't imagine myself writing a letter like this. And I can't imagine anyone that I know writing a letter with all of this stuff packed into it. So you have to ask yourself all the way through this, why in the world would Paul spend all this time developing these very intricate and involved arguments for this group of people that basically doesn't even begin to talk about their actual behavior until, chapters 8, 9, 10, and 11. I mean, he's way into this letter before he starts talking about how they should behave, right? It just strikes me that if we don't keep that in mind, we'll read this letter as though Paul's writing a theological work, right? We'll forget that this is a personal letter that he's writing to this congregation where he has to have some kind of connection with these people. And we'll read it like most Christians read it, as though Paul is providing his Summa Theologica, and it's completely divorced from the actual living situation, right? So as we go through this, it's going to be really hard, because the Christian church has used this so much for the foundation of its theology, and particularly its relationship between law and grace, that it's hard for us to step back from that and constantly ask ourselves, why would Paul even want to talk about this with these people? Why does he even care? Why do they even care? If they're in a synagogue environment and as James says, they're learning Moses every week, why does Paul go through all this effort to try to develop this long and involved argument to you know, justify his points. So we're going to have to ask that question again and again in order to keep moving away from, you know, viewing the entire letter through the lens of Christian theology. Okay? So just a background comment. Now, and importantly, part of what's going to happen now in this development, because now he introduces the idea of Abraham. And so in chapter 4, we're going to have to start dealing with what was happening that Paul would even care about saying, well, what about our father Abraham, right? Okay, so let's jump into the text now and see how he develops this. Okay, so first, let's get to the verse first. So I'm reading from the NASB. What then shall we say that Abraham, our forefather, according to the flesh, has found? Okay, so you might have different translations for this. I think it's important to look at this point, we're going to look at Uriel ben Mordecai's Kosher Paul for most of these verses because there's really important shifts going on here. And he translates it, so what shall we profess to deduce about Abraham Avenu from a human perspective, right? Because he's interpreting the NASB's translation of what he has found as what did Abraham know from a human perspective, okay? And so let's look at that and ask, what was it that, first question, excuse me, why introduce Abraham at this point? Right? He's already convinced his audience that everyone has sinned and fallen short of the glory of God and everybody deserves to be punished and it doesn't make any difference if you're Jew and Gentile. So why even introduce Abraham? If everyone is in the same boat, who cares about Abraham? Okay? But he needs Abraham to distinguish between what the Christian Bible translates as works or righteousness. This is the Lutheran conflict between grace and work. Okay? And we're going to see that Christianity reads this passage, this chapter, one way, and Orthodox Judaism reads it another way. Same words, different paradigm. Okay? So the first thing that Paul says is, okay, wait a minute. We've now had this long argument, chapters 1, 2, and 3, about the condition of all mankind. But the issue of Abraham is still outstanding because someplace along the way, he's going to want to say, but wait a minute, something happened with Abraham that provided a foundation that will change this relationship that everybody's in the same boat. Okay? And we're going to see what that looks like. So he says, what did Abraham discover? Okay? Now, verse 2 is really, really, it's actually verse 2 and 3 are really important. And the problem with verse 2 and 3 is the way that they're translated. So he says in this, for if Abraham was justified by works, he has something to boast about, but not before God. Okay, that's one way it's translated. Here's Ben Mordecai's translation. Well, it may in fact be that Abraham had satisfaction from being perceived as tzedek, apart from deeds, and really not just before God. Okay, so that's one version. Now, let's go back and look at what happens with these critical words. Okay? Because what Paul has just introduced becomes the foundation for the Christian difference between law and grace. Okay? So he says, again, the verse, if Abraham was justified by works, and you should stop right there, underline the word works, ergon, in Greek, and ask yourself, what does that mean? Because in the Christian world, works is anything that I do on the human side that would supposedly grant me a relationship with God. And as I pointed out here in my notes, Paul raises the possibility that Abraham was justified by his own efforts. This was the view widely held by Jews. And you're going to say, wait a minute, that sounds like a condemnation of Jews from a Christian perspective. And it is, except that in the Jewish world, it's not called works, it's called merit. And there's a difference, okay? Because even like my rabbi here, he talks about the merit. he was praying for somebody that I know who's really, really sick. And he wanted to know the mother's name. And then he said, okay, we will do this study today, because we were doing a study in Joshua. We'll do this study today for merit on her behalf. In other words, we'll really, really study hard, because God will see how hard we are and diligent we are in our study of Torah, and he will account that merit to this woman who's sick so that he might heal her. And of course, we prayed for her as well, but you can see the concept. The concept is, if I do something righteous, that matters to God, and it matters in a way that he might change his mind about other things, okay? That's different than, merit is different than the idea of self-fulfilling work. Things that I do for myself, right? For example, if you go to Jerusalem and you go to Yad Vashem, and I've mentioned this before, there's a walkway that has trees on both sides, and it's called the Path of the Righteous Gentile. And on that path are memorials to various Gentiles who have done great service to the Jews. Now, they don't get merit for themselves. What the merit is accrued to them because of what they did for someone else. So when Paul says in his letter, if Abraham was justified by works, he has something to boast about, we have to remember that in Paul's mind, actions that apply to myself for my own good, for my own well-being, not shalom, but for my own status, are the kinds of things that Paul might have in mind with the idea of work. How do you know that? Because the Greek word ergon really means active effort on one's behalf. Okay? And in Hellenistic Judaism, this is a note, in Hellenistic Judaism, everything called ergon, that's the Greek word that Paul uses, everything called ergon in human life is sin. Why? Because it's measured against the ultimate standard of God's righteousness. So when Paul says, and he uses the Greek word on purpose, if Abraham is justified by works, and everyone in the Orthodox community would know when he uses the word ergon, he's talking about the kind of work that satisfies myself, the kind of work that I do in order to gain my own righteousness, right? And everybody in the Orthodox community would know that Paul's using a word that in Hellenistic Judaism means sinful act. Okay? So, of course, Abraham can't be justified on the basis of sinful acts, because if he does that, it's just exactly the opposite of what God would expect. Righteousness is accrued not because of something I do for myself, but because of some other action, which we're going to see. Okay? So, for example, the works of God, ergon theos, is considered good, but the works of man are considered self-will and therefore bad. Okay? So, in this argument, the first thing Paul says about Abraham is, if Abraham did this on the basis of ergon, that is self-willed accrual to himself, he had nothing to boast about at all, especially in front of God, because everyone knows in the Jewish Hellenistic world that ergon is sinful. Okay? Now let's look at verse 3. Lots of stuff going on in verse 3. Okay. In verse 3, he says, because here comes his argument, for what does Scripture say? And here's the citation from Genesis 15:6. And Abraham, believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. So we got two really, really important words here. We have them in Greek, but because he is citing a passage in the Tanakh, it's important to go back and understand what was happening in Hebrew, right? Because Paul is not giving you a Greek version of a Hebrew text. He's actually trying to translate that Hebrew text into Greek so that he captures the Hebrew idea. So, we have to go back and ask, what's going on in Genesis 15:6 when it comes to the words believe and righteous, right? Because those are the critical words. So I wrote this up, and now I don't see it. Hold on just a second. I have to go find it. Romans. Okay, here we go. Maybe I put it someplace else. Yeah, okay. So here we go. In Genesis 15:6, okay, the first word that's important is the word believed. Okay? And you know that it comes from aman, the same root that we have for other words in the Tanakh that mean to confirm, to support, to uphold, to establish, to be faithful to be certain of. But here's the important thing. In the Hebrew text, this verb form is the hifil, right? H-I-F apostrophe I-L. And it is a perfect, it's in the perfect tense, which means it's a finished action, but the hifil is a causative verb. In other words, it doesn't say that Abraham believed. It says that Abraham was caused to believe, or Abraham caused himself to believe, except it's not passive, right? So in the Hebrew text, it isn't Abraham who sort of gathers up his spiritual energy to force himself to believe so that God will accept him. Something else is happening so that Abraham believes. But Abraham believes on the basis of something that causes him to believe. Okay? Do you understand what I'm saying? We have this idea that when Paul says Abraham believed, it's as though Abraham's spiritual effort caused him to have faith in God. But that's not what that Hebrew text says. The Hebrew text says that something caused Abraham to believe. It wasn't Abraham that was doing the causing. Something was causing it. Okay? And, more importantly, when Paul cites this in the Greek text, let me see if I can catch up now. He uses the word kasa. Oh, sorry, nope, wrong one. In the Greek text. Oh, my gosh. In the Greek text. Hold on. For what does Scripture say? He uses the word pistiu, from which we have found over and over and over in the Gospels, particularly in John, where he uses it 92 times. And pistiu is the usual translation for Greek for what we have believe, but its root is in the same Hebrew word aman that we're talking about. So it doesn't necessarily mean, as I pointed out, that even in the Greek text, it doesn't mean that Abraham gathered his spiritual energy to make this happen. It's as though the text is saying Abraham was made to believe. So something else was happening that caused Abraham to have this belief. And more importantly now is the connection between belief and what happens as a result of that. Because look what he says. And Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. Okay, so this is the great Lutheran passage. Luther calls this alien righteousness. And what he means is Abraham had no spiritual value at all until God accounted him with the value. That is, that God gave Abraham righteousness. And the reason Luther calls it alien righteousness is because Luther wants to make the argument that Abraham didn't deserve it. Okay? That, by the way, is the foundation of the Reformation theology, that somehow God imputes righteousness on the basis of God's own decision, right? Okay, so let's look and see what's happening here. The word in Hebrew is asav. Let's make sure that I have it right. Why does Paul address this asav? Yep. Okay. So in Hebrew, is asav, and it means to plan or to think or to make a judgment or to imagine or to count. And in this case, it's heshavon. It's heshavon. And it's the fourth variation of the verb chasav. And it means, check this out, to impute actually is a specialized sense of to make a judgment. This variation occurs three times in the kal and three times in the nifal, the latter simply being the passive. It refers to both God and man. Shimei, after blatantly cursing David, beseeches David not to impute sin unto him. More significantly, and here it is, God is spoken of as imputing Abraham, Abraham believed God and God counted or imputed it to him for righteousness, right? So what's happening is Abraham was caused to have faith in some way or another, and God recognized that and determined on that basis that Abraham would be called a tzedek, righteous. Okay. But here's the question. Is it anything that Abraham actually did? And the answer, of course, is, well, yes, it is something that Abraham did because Abraham trusted. But it doesn't mean, because belief is the idea of to uphold, to support, right? But it doesn't mean that that action of Abraham's was all his own. What it means is that Abraham had a history that he trusted God to be faithful to, and God recognized that and called Abraham tzedekah, righteous, on that basis. Now, we know from our previous studies that tzedekah, righteous, it means conformity to the standard that's expected, the social standard. In this case, conformity to the standard that God expects. So what happened is this. Abraham, because of some reason, is caused to trust God, and God recognizes that Abraham's trust means that he will continue to behave in such a way that he will conform to God's standard, and God therefore recognizes Abraham as a tzedekah, as a tzedek. Okay? But wait, we know that Abraham doesn't always do that. We know from Abraham's own history that he's up and down and all over the place, and he finally only actually comes to full recognition of the terms at the very end of his life. Okay? So what we're really discovering in Paul is that Paul is saying Abraham's history brought him to a place where he was willing to trust God, and God recognized that willingness and counted him as a tzedek, even if his life was going to be up and down from that point on. Because in God's view, he was a true follower. Okay? Doesn't mean that he was without sin. It means that he was a true follower. Okay? So why is that important? Because what's happening here is that we'll recognize that Paul's argument isn't just a matter of, okay, well, Abraham can't be justified by works, therefore it must be all grace. No, it's much more complicated than that. That there's something else going on that isn't Aragon that allows Abraham to come to believe, to be caused to believe. And when God recognizes that, he recognizes Abraham's willingness to adopt the position of a tzedek, which is to be in relation to the standard that God chooses, which means that Abraham is accounted tzedekah because Abraham's willingness is to conform himself to the law, to the Torah, right? Even before he doesn't have the Torah, but he's conforming himself to the standard that God expresses, right? So it isn't as though Abraham's quote unquote faith is independent of the law. Of course, the law isn't given, the Mosaic code isn't given, but the very fact that God counts Abraham as tzedek means that Abraham's willingness is to obey God. So obedience is locked right into this whole idea of reliance on God or reliance on God's faithfulness. Okay? Which is why Mordecai, Ben Mordecai can translate verse 3 as, in all honesty, what does the written account say? And he trusted Hashem, and righteousness was ascribed to him. Okay? And of course, righteousness means conformity to the accepted standard, as we've discovered before. Okay. That takes us to verse 4. And verse 4 has another really interesting twist to it, because look what verse 4 says. Now, the one who works, his wage is not reckoned as a favor, but as what is due. Okay? So here's Paul referring again to Hellenistic Judaism's idea of ergon, right? The one who works, the one who does things for his own benefit, right? That's ergon. And of course, in Hellenistic Judaism, that was considered sinful because it was all about me, right? And Paul says, okay, the one who does things for his own benefit, he's not granted the position of a tzaddik because, why? Because he's just getting what was due him, right? He's working for his wages, not for, and what Paul is going to say is, not for, in the next verse, a charis, a gift, a favor, okay? So if we go to the next verse and we look at what he's saying in 4, well, let's back up for a second. In 4:3, pistiu, which was to trust, right? We need to point out, I forgot to point out that it's in the aorist tense, which we don't have in English, but it means a completed action in the past, okay?
Skip, can I just ask one thing? Is Paul saying, Paul's not saying that that's bad, verse 4, that working for what is due is bad, is he? He's just saying...
He's not saying that working for your wages is a bad thing. What he's saying is, it doesn't have the same effect as what applied to Abraham. In other words, what he's contrasting the reliance that Abraham had, the trust that Abraham had, and God's reaction to it with the one who thinks that he is due it because he's worked at it. Okay? So let's back up. The Christian idea that Jews believe that they work their way toward righteousness is absolutely wrong, because every Jew knows that that gaining merit is not the same as the establishment of the relationship with God. Okay? In other words, if you only had to have the relationship with God based on merit, you wouldn't need a sacrificial system. The sacrificial system is there because Jews recognize that the fundamental relationship is based on grace, right? But it doesn't mean that the faithful reliance an agreement. It's not the word that I want, but I can't think of it. It doesn't mean that faithful reliance and agreement with the accepted standard is thereby set aside, right? It's not. So, in other words, what I'm saying is that the reliance that Abraham has, which it causes him to trust God, is part and parcel with his obedience, which is what God recognizes, his willingness to obey, okay? So that's part of the Jewish arrangement. So, of course, if I use the word Greek word ergon in its Hellenistic Jewish sense, then it's of no value when it comes to the relationship with God, because God doesn't work on the basis of what you earn, right? He works on the basis of your trust and reliance on him and your faithful obedience to him. But the two work hand in glove. One can't be separated from the other, right? So in this verse, when he says, if you thought that it was only about what you could earn, then, you know, you get paid your dues. And by the way, remember that he's already said the wages of sin is death, right? So if he uses ergon in that sense, you're going to get paid what you're due. In other words, you aren't going to achieve this relationship with God called tzedakah, right? Now, but we need verse 5. But to the one who does not work, but believes in him, who justifies the ungodly, his faith is reckoned as righteousness. Okay, but we're going to back up now and remember that the one who does not work is the same as saying the one who does not rely on his own efforts, because he's using work in this sense that work is a self-willed advancement, right? He's not saying that you just sit back and don't do anything. What he's contrasting is the person who believes that the only thing necessary for a relationship with God is self-fulfilled effort, as opposed to the one who realizes that he's been caused to have faith in God and his obedience flows from that, not the other way around. Right? He doesn't have faith because he's obedient. He is obedient because he has faith. He has trust in God and therefore he obeys, as opposed to the man who does everything that he thinks he can do and then expects God to reward him for it. Right? That would be like verse 4, where he says, okay, if you think that this is the wages that you're due, then, you know, you don't have anything to boast about, because you're only getting paid for what you're due. Okay, and he needs this argument to set up his comment about circumcision, which is going to happen next. Okay, so let's make sure that we understand what's going on here, because these three or four verses now become the way that Paul will jump into what do we do about the circumcised and uncircumcised. Okay, so any further questions or remarks to let us jump forward again? Right? He's going to use David as his example, but the point that he's trying to make is, if I am involved in what I think is earning my way to righteousness by doing what I'm doing to take care of myself, I've missed the point. Because even Abraham was like that. Abraham had trusted God would fulfill his commitment without Abraham deciding that he could earn it. Okay? So in one sense, the Christian theology is right. You don't earn your way to God. But that's not the same as saying it's all grace. Because obviously, righteousness is this idea of being in alignment with God's expectations. So if I'm counted righteous, that means that God recognizes my trust in him and considers me one who is willing to obey God's instructions. And that gets borne out in life, as we're going to see in the next example from David. Okay? Ready? Okay, I assume we are. So let's go to verse 6 then.
Wait, 1 second. Where it says, but to the one who does not work but believes in him who justifies the ungodly, what does he mean by that, justifies the ungodly?
Okay, so, but to the one who does not work, that is the one who doesn't act in a self-fulfilling, you owe me kind of way, right? Okay, but believes in him, God, who justifies the ungodly, because he would say, okay, so if I'm going to be justified, if I believe that God is the one who reckons the person who doesn't fulfill the commandments as righteous, and this argument, of course, is that's how Abraham happened, because Abraham didn't have the commandments to fulfill, but he was still counted as righteous on the basis of his willingness to be and his acceptance of the faithfulness of God, right? So Paul is saying, okay, wait a minute. How about he wants to classify Abraham this way. Abraham is not one whose life is bent on earning his right before God, okay? But he is one who believes that God will justify those who are outside of the faith, the ungodly. Because remember, Abraham isn't circumcised yet. That's going to show up in the next few verses, right? So Abraham is not a member of the covenant community yet. He will become the father of the covenant community, but after God has already recognized his willingness to be obedient.
Okay? But nobody was circumcised back then.
Well, that's historically, I mean, that isn't true, because the Egyptians practice circumcision. But in terms of the Jewish nation, you're right. Circumcision is a rite that gets its spiritual connotation with Abraham. But Paul's argument is all of this stuff about Abraham's willingness to obey and Abraham's trust in God happens before circumcision, not afterwards, right? So from Abraham's perspective, he's not someone who's trying to make himself good enough for God, earning his own way, but he believes that God will justify those people who haven't qualified, and he hasn't qualified yet because he hasn't been circumcised, he hasn't demonstrated his obedience to the Torah commandments because they're just being revealed, but he has a willingness to obey, and that's what God is recognizing. Okay, does that make sense? Yes? Okay, so let's see, Skip,
he's already been given the covenant of the parts even before circumcision, if I've got my parts right.
He's already been given the covenant of the what, I'm sorry?
Of the parts, walking through. He's been given the, he's been given the promise. He's been given the covenant. He was ratified.
That's an important point. But I would say he's been given the promise because he didn't walk through. God walked through. Right?
Yeah.
Abraham is the beneficiary of something that God does. Right? So think about this. Remember we talked about the hifel tense of the word believe. Okay? So basically what we're saying is Abraham was caused to believe. And of course, one of the evidences that causes Abraham to believe is the fact that God is willing to make the promise to himself without putting Abraham on the line for a commitment that he knows that Abraham might break. Okay? So you're right. The precursor to the covenant occurs when God walks between the separated animals. Okay? And that promise means that Abraham is the beneficiary of something that God does. Right. Okay? And of course, that's reflected in that he believed, which is a positive action. Something happened that caused Abraham to trust God. And maybe part of it is that God was willing to take on the obligation on himself rather than to put Abraham on the line. And Abraham recognizes that he's the beneficiary, and that causes him to trust God. And it's the trust in God that Abraham has that God recognizes as the willingness to be obedient, and therefore he counts him as a follower, as one of the family.
It's the same as not saying faith in Yeshua, but the faith of Yeshua. And there's a difference.
That's a good point. Because there's a passage in Galatians which can be translated either way. One is to say that you have to have belief in Yeshua. And the other one is to say that the belief of Yeshua is the one that causes this change to occur. And it's a parallel to the same idea. Okay. Okay. So the point is that when, yes, Michael.
Yeah. What of the idea that Abraham did obey commandments that were passed down orally from Adam and Enoch and Noah?
Well, if we went through the Genesis passages and we looked for examples of the commandments that occurred before the commandments were codified, because all they were really doing with the Ten Commandments is codifying what was expected of the population already, right? It's not like these were brand new laws and they'd never heard of them before. Some of them are like that, but most of them are the kinds of spiritual and moral expectations that were resident in the Hebrew community from the very beginning. And you can find those, you can find hints of those all the way through the Genesis account. So it's not like Abraham was a stranger to these commitments, right? But they weren't given they weren't set in stone yet, right? They were expectations. So what's really happening in this passage in Genesis 15:6 is that God is saying Abraham had cause to believe, right? He had reasons. He had examples, and Lindy brought up one of them. And as a result of that, God looks and sees that he has a willingness in his heart to continue to be obedient to the expectations that God has, even if they haven't yet been codified. Okay? And you can find examples of that in Abraham's life. But my point is, you will also find examples in Abraham's life where he does the wrong thing. But it doesn't change the relationship that God has established with Abraham. So there are two pieces to this. The first piece is that Abraham has evidence for his trust in God. It isn't that he, you know, that he boosts himself up to make a spiritual commitment without any, you know, he's not making a leap of faith, okay? He has evidence. He has God's call, lech lecha. He has the separation of the animals. He has God's blessing over him even when he's made huge mistakes like with Pharaoh, right? He has all that evidence that causes him to trust in God. And it's the trust in God that is recognized by God and treated as a sign of obedience, righteousness, okay? So,
you know, it's really,
so yes, watched, Genesis is filled with examples of why we should think of Abraham as the kind of person who was willing to be Torah observant even without the codification of the Torah. Yes, Lindy?
Even, you know, you just brought something, I hope this is related. So you said that Abraham caused Abraham to have trust in God, but we still have to remember he was a man. So when he went down to Egypt, he was afraid that they would take Sarah and kill him, which is what they did. It's not, oh my God, because that was what they did when they saw a beautiful wife or a woman.
Sure.
I mean, there were women back then, and they would take them and kill the other men and take them for themselves. And so he still was a man concerned that this could happen. Not just only it could destroy Sarah, and also it could happen. So even though he had faith or trust, and he had this promise, and he was walking in that promise as much as you could say, he still, I mean, that's a beautiful thing for us. He still was a person like us. So his faith.
Yes. The first indication that you get of that in that is after chapter 12, when he leaves Ur, right? And he's following God with a willingness to go where God tells him to go, which he doesn't know. And when he gets there, he makes the sacrifice and the altar and stuff. And then it says, and then there was a famine. And immediately he does human things, right? He runs off to Egypt because he's worried about the famine in spite of the fact that God has already called him to be in this place, right? So his quote-unquote faith vacillates up and down. But that's not what God recognizes here. What God is recognizing is that Abraham was caused to have faith in God over the long haul, and as a result of that, God recognizes his willingness to be obedient, and that's what Paul is commenting on. So he's saying in this verse where he says the one who doesn't work, he's saying the one who doesn't attempt to self-fulfill his religious status, right? But who believes that God is willing to deal with the quote unquote those outside the kingdom, the ungodly, that man doesn't have to worry about reward. He's not getting paid his dues. He's getting a status that's granted as a favor. Charis is the word, grace. It's granted on the basis of grace, right? Now let's go forward and see how he uses David as an example of exactly this, okay? So he has, in verse 6, just as David also speaks of the blessing upon the man to whom God reckons righteousness, so there it is again, right, who reckons, that counts, right, righteousness, tzedekah, apart from what? Apart from ergon, apart from self-fulfilling works, okay? We need to look at the term. Hold on just a second. I want to go back to this passage from the Psalms. Okay, so here we go. We need another book. I'm now in Robert Alter's translation of Psalm 32. He says, because this is a quote from Psalm 32, so we need to know what the context of Psalm 32 is. So here's the Psalm. A David Maskil. Happy, of sin forgiven, absolved of offense, happy the man to whom the Lord reckons no crime, in whose spirit is no deceit. Okay? And Alter says the following. In this particular psalm, there also may be a punning reference to a homonym that means discerning person or giver of instruction. The word translated, let me teach you, in verse 8 employs the same root. Hermann Gunkel noted that the psalm contains distinct wisdom elements, especially from verse 8 on, so we need to know the whole thing, right? As to genre, while it has sometimes been described as a Thanksgiving psalm, it is really more a confession in the, and this is important, in the perfect tense. The speaker admits that he has transgressed, affirms that he has confessed his transgression, and that as a result, God has granted him forgiveness. Okay? So why do I want to emphasize the perfect tense? Because in Hebrew, the perfect tense means a completed action. There's only two tenses in Hebrew, perfect and imperfect. Right? There's a whole bunch of moods, like hefel, nifal, kal, etc. But there's only two versions of verb tenses. Either something is finished or it's not finished. And according to this psalm, it's finished. So Paul is saying, when, and by the way, blessed is the same word that's used in Matthew, right? So it's basically a beatitude that comes from the Old Testament or from the Tanakh. And what David is saying is, this is a finished action, right? It isn't an ongoing situation that I have to be constantly reminded to seek repentance because I've piled up more sins. He's saying, blessed is the man who's been forgiven. It's a finished action. Something has happened in the relationship with God so that God recognizes the willingness to be obedient, and that counts with God. Okay? And then he says, blessed is the man whose sin the Lord will not take into account. And there the word in Hebrew is to calculate. Okay? In fact, even in Greek, it's logizomai, and it means to calculate. It also means to make a plan. Okay? So, in Abraham's case, it's a passive recipient. He was credited in the aorist tense in Greek. And David, in David's case, he is finished with forgiveness. It has been done. It's finished. Okay? And in both cases, it's not the basis for what the man did. It's the basis, it's based on God's character of willingness to not count the disobedience in light of the person's willingness to continue in obedience, right? So faithfulness in God is the ongoing process that removes the individual scorecard kind of thing. Let me see if I can give you another example. In Psalm 32, verse 2, the word for impute is hasad, is hasav. Hold on, I got to give you that. I want to talk about that for a second. So hasav means something important for us here. Psalm 32, 2. The verb. Okay, so in this verb means to make a judgment, to imagine, to count, right? And in this case, it's exactly the same verb that's used of Abraham. And what it actually means is to not make a judgment over, okay? So it doesn't mean that somehow Abraham or David have accrued a spiritual status. It means that God has decided not to judge them on the basis of this situation, right? So David can say, isn't it wonderful that God can make decisions, make judgments that aren't condemnations of us, that he's willing to make a judgment that is based on our long-term character instead of the individual act. And in Abraham's case, Abraham has all this evidence and shows that he's willing, and God makes a judgment over that, right? He doesn't impute to Abraham like we would, like Luther thinks of impute, as though somehow Abraham from that point on gains a spiritual status that's different than before. If we read the word chasav in Hebrew, it means that God decides to make a, God makes a decision over this. He makes a judgment call, and he doesn't consider Abraham ungodly, and he doesn't consider David unforgiven. He makes a judgment call, and David is saying, isn't it wonderful when that happens? Okay? So, that takes us through the Psalm passage, and it takes us to verse 9. Is this blessing then upon the circumcised or upon the uncircumcised? And of course, now Paul wants to say, the same action that occurs for Abraham can occur when Abraham was uncircumcised, can occur for you when you're uncircumcised. In other words, the precondition to God's judgment doesn't occur on the basis of a mark of the symbol of the covenant. It occurs on the basis of the willingness to trust. And the symbol of the covenant comes afterwards. The symbol of the covenant is a marker that says, my relationship with God has changed, right? So I don't get circumcised in order to get grace from God. The circumcision comes because I'm being obedient to God after he's already granted me this relationship, after he's also already made the judgment call. And that is the important point for Paul, because he's speaking to a Jewish and Gentile audience. And on the Jewish side, he does not want circumcision to become a necessary condition of forgiveness. And on the Gentile side, he doesn't want them to think that because they've been forgiven, circumcision doesn't matter. Okay? He's got to play both sides at the same time. So on the Jewish side, he's saying, okay, look at Abraham. Abraham was counted by God. Abraham was given a judgment prior to circumcision. Does that mean that Abraham didn't have to exhibit anything and he just had to sit back and let God do it? No, because the point is that Abraham was caused to believe on the basis of his trust in the relationship that he'd already seen with God. He had all this evidence and examples before he came to the point where he believed. Okay? But on the basis of his trust in God, God made a judgment call. And on that judgment call, Abraham then continued to be obedient. And the very next thing that God asks of him is circumcision, which is the symbol that represents the established relationship between God and Abraham. Now, what Paul is arguing is that symbol didn't make the difference. The symbol was the result of the relationship, not the initiator of the relationship. And of course, he needs to make that point because he's got Gentiles in the Roman assembly who are not circumcised. And he doesn't want them to go around saying, I don't need to be circumcised because after all, God's already accepted me. And he doesn't want the Jews in the assembly to say, you're not allowed into the assembly because you haven't been circumcised and therefore God isn't part of your life. You understand? You understand? He's got to play both sides. He's got to show the Jews that even the father of their faith had circumcision happen after the judgment, and he's got to show the Gentiles that circumcision just doesn't get set aside simply because you have an established relationship. Circumcision is the symbol that you are of your willingness to be obedient. Okay? Do you understand? Questions? Once he's at this point, then he's going to continue with, what does this mean for everybody? Okay?
So in the Christian faith, they just take the paradigm that you're forgiven, you don't need to do anything else, and they forget about what he's actually saying because he's talking to two groups in the same assembly. They just disregard the rest, and they just say, well, he's just saying you're forgiven and you don't have to worry about anything else. How do they do that, though?
Right.
But
historically, I can tell you how they do that, because in the Christian faith, baptism becomes the substitution for circumcision. In other words, you'll recall in the Christian faith how important baptism is. In fact, baptism is the symbol of your willingness to be in relationship with God that God has established, right? So in Judaism, circumcision is the symbolic representation of your willingness to be in relationship to God. In Christianity, baptism is the symbol. Both religions have a symbol. It's just that the Christian church could not have accepted circumcision as a symbol because then they would have been Jewish. So they found something else, baptism, and they made baptism the symbol.
When did that happen?
And you will recognize that that's the case when you realize that if you move from one church to another church, you are asked, have you been baptized? And if you have been baptized, you can't be baptized again. You can only be baptized once, like circumcision, right? Okay?
But baptism in
the Jewish world is very different than circumcision. The church just substituted baptism, a one-time event, in order to not have circumcision. Yes.
So the church took the mikvahs when you go into the ceremony of bath before you go in the temple. They took that. Is that how they took that action and turned it into a symbol of a one-time pledge, basically?
Yeah, of course. But think about it. You can think about why they had to do that, because if the church had said, okay, now you have been forgiven by God and you need to be circumcised, they would have been Jewish, right? Because that's exactly what the Jews were saying, right? So the church couldn't say that, so they had to have something else to substitute for the symbol of a mark of being a follower. And the symbol mark in Judaism is circumcision, and the symbolic mark in Christianity is baptism.
When did that become?
They merely converted the Jewish ritual into something else.
When did baptism become a thing, so to speak, as that? When did that happen?
For the church, baptism became a thing for the church after the second century, right? I mean, think about it. Think about what's happening. Okay, so we know that the last four or five chapters of Matthew, there are no earlier copies than before Constantine. But what does Matthew 28 say? Baptizing them in the name of, right? Okay, so do you suppose that a Jew would have said, go into all the world, preach the gospel, teach them the commandments, et cetera, baptizing them, right? As though somehow the ritual, the most important ritual is the baptism? I think that's a church addition. The same thing happens at the end of Mark. In the passage at the end of Mark, which every scholar knows was added later, it's the same idea, that somehow baptism, and besides which, think about it in Matthew, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit? Come on. That's not a Jewish idea at all. But it's in there because the church needs a representative symbol of your commitment to the Christian God. And it happens when you transmute the symbol of Judaism, circumcision, into baptism. And by the way, obviously it's from circumcision is a male marker, right? It's not a female marker, but baptism is a marker for everyone. So the church moved away from more than one element of the Jewish faith, which was where the father is the head of household, into a Greco-Roman individualistic world where everybody can get baptized.
But we don't really know who decided that was going to be the thing. There's no actual...
No, we just know that it started. I mean, look, John's disciples come to Yeshua and they say, John was baptizing. Are you going to do the same thing? No, by the way, you should notice that how many people does Yeshua baptize?
None.
None. It must have been a really important ritual, huh? He doesn't baptize a single person, not even the disciples, right? But every time he went to the temple, he baptized himself, right? So all kinds of crazy things going on when the church adopted and made this ritual into a one-time event, because it doesn't follow any of the history of what Yeshua did with his disciples and with himself. Right? You suppose that Yeshua needed to be baptized over and over and over to remove sin from his life? I don't think so. I mean, the whole point is that baptism in a Jewish context is very different than baptism in the church context. And when Paul talks about circumcision in this context, he is now treading on a ritual that the church gets rid of in order not to be Jewish.
Can I ask something? Okay. The author of Hebrews says that there's a foundational teaching on the baptisms. What does he mean then?
I don't recall the remark in the letter to the Hebrews. Can you give me the verse reference?
I think it's Hebrews 11.
Okay, so if you find the verse reference, then I can go take a look. But I don't recall it offhand.
Okay, I will do it.
Skip.
Yes, everybody went to, before they went to the temple, before they would go up to the temple, if you go to Israel, you'll see there's a lot of, they've discovered the mikvahs. They just went through the mikvah. And today it's still taken, I mean, there's not a temple, but men still go. They go before holidays. Many men go for before Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. The women go on a ritual basis of every month, depending. But it's not a sign. It's just something that is what you do.
Of course. Yes.
It was a standard thing to do. That's what they did.
Standard practice.
But
not a one-time event. Michael Stanley, you were going to say something?
Yeah, you know, you talked about how a church asks you if you've been baptized. And they won't baptize you again, but you know, I've been baptized 10 different times because there's every church, every denomination has its own, you know, rules and guidelines where you baptize in still water or running water or in the name of Jesus or in the name of the Father, Son.
But listen, Michael, you're going to have to stop switching denominations because if you just stay in the same denomination, you only have to do it once, right? But when you start jumping around all over the place, you're right, they all have different. But the point is, my point is, even if you get baptized more than once because you switch denominations, my point is that becomes the critical ritual. I can guarantee you this. If you want to join a church, no one's going to ask you if you're circumcised. I can guarantee you that. Okay.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, I'm glad I'm Jewish and been circumcised in time.
But if you join a Jewish synagogue, then that's the most important thing. But as long as you stay in the Christian world, no one's going to ask you about circumcision. That's for sure. Okay? So the point is, Paul is offering an argument in a synagogue that has both Jews and Gentiles, some circumcised and some not. And he doesn't want circumcision to become the dividing point for the assembly. He wants to show that in the history of circumcision, Abraham was reckoned by the faithfulness of God prior to circumcision, but that doesn't mean that circumcision doesn't count, right? It means that in the order in which God created the Jewish people, circumcision came after the relationship, not before it, right? And for the Gentiles, this is really important because it means that the Jewish religious ritual that the Orthodox Jews in the assembly may insist on doesn't have anything to do with the establishment of the relationship, but it is a mark of obedience. So all that kind of stuff he has to deal with in this congregation has both kinds of people in it. Okay.
In today, and if somebody converts to Judaism, if you have been in the world, people are circumcised. If you have already been circumcised, there's still a ritual of being pricked to draw blood. So that still is something that's extremely important. So just know that it's a one-time thing.
Yeah.
But if you are just joining or becoming an MOT or whatever you want to call it, you join.
Sure,
you know, that's something you will do, but only us.
Right, but it's an acknowledgement of the ritual. That's what it amounts to. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so we're going to stop here because now we're halfway through the chapter, and the really important establishment of this issue that Paul wants to deal with is going to come up now for the rest of the chapter. He's going to have to start dealing with, okay, well, the relationship between the Jew and the Gentile in terms of the Torah, and so we'll attack that tomorrow and look at how he now develops this argument. Once he's established the foundation, now how does he develop that so that he can talk to both groups? Okay? Any other comments or questions for today?
Okay. Hey, Skip, most important thing.
Okay, go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, I'm just curious. I'm just now rereading your book, Lucky Life. So Abraham Makaris lucky because he's already living this.
Yeah, okay, so the Greek makarioi is the word that's translated blessed are the such and such, but it obviously is the wrong word because makarioi means happy or lucky, and that's why I read you from Alter's translation of Psalm 32 where he says happy the man, right? He isn't blessed. He doesn't receive some spiritual favor. He's just recognized as somebody who's fortunate. Right? That's why I called the book Lucky Life, because he's lucky. Okay? The important thing, and of course, when he quotes from Psalm 32, he uses the same word in Hebrew, Ashrei. Okay? But the important thing for today, as far as I'm concerned, two important things. First is that the Hebrew verb for and he believed in Genesis 15:6 is a hifil causative perfect. Okay, which tells me that it wasn't something Abraham did. Okay, he was caused to, and I don't know exactly how that works, but we've got some suggestions. And the second thing is the return to the word righteousness, tzedakah, right, which is conformity to the ethical and spiritual standards of the community, in this case, God, right? So the linking of belief and obedience is as tight as it could get in the Hebrew, and it's only the church that separated that by drawing a line between ergon and charis, between works and grace, which doesn't happen in Paul's citations and doesn't happen in Abraham's life either. Okay? All right. We'll pick it up tomorrow and see what we do in the rest of the chapter.